Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live in afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio this afternoon is neurosurgeon Dr. Peter Zejos. He practices with Brain and Spine Surgeons of New York and Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. His focus is the surgical treatment of spinal disease, brain tumors, neurotrauma, and deep brain stimulation. He is also involved in the development of non-invasive spinal disc repair. Dr. Zejos earned his medical degree from George Washington University, completed his neurological training at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and fellowship training at UCLA. Prior to coming to the Hudson Valley, Dr. Zejos was associate clinical professor of neurological surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Zejos, welcome to Vox Pop.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you here. To be part of today's conversation, give us a call, 1-800-348-2551. Ladies and gentlemen, every phone is going to be busy in a minute. So if you want to get in on it, do it early. Please don't wait and yell at me later. 1-800-348-2551, or you can write us at voxpop@wamc.org. And it's just great to have you here. So let me start, Doc, with you and ask you this. Deep brain work is primarily for diseases like Parkinson's?
That's right. It's generally for Parkinson's, for essential tremor, for movement disorders. There are also experimental treatments for psychiatric disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Like what do you do?
It's a different target. Every target for deep brain stimulation is a different part of the brain. Uh-huh. And they found that by stimulating that part of the brain, they would be able to suppress the symptoms.
And it works?
It works. It's a bit of a black box. You know, we sort of know why it works, but we're not like 100%. But we found that over 20 years, particularly for Parkinson's disease and essential tremor, can be very effective.
Too bad that you weren't around for Jack Nicholson and one flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Right. Yeah, we might have given him another option.
Might have given him a lobotomy.
Yeah, yes.
Which they did.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, tell me, when you do brain surgery, mm-hmm. How fear? Do you get afraid when you do it?
You know, you look back at the beginning of your career, and if you don't have some degree of trepidation and fear, you're not thinking it through. The first time you put a scalpel to the scalp, the first time you drill into the skull, you better have a healthy degree of fear. But over time, part of the training is to suppress or eliminate that fear. So at this stage, I can't feel that, and I don't. And if I did, it would sort of hobble me. So I basically will know and rehearse the steps of the surgery, you know, 5-10 steps ahead, and you just become engrossed in that process. So no, fear doesn't come into it, but there is a respect for the brain that you never leaves you.
Well, the phones are really ringing off the hook, as I knew they would. But before we move ahead, let me just ask you about your group. You've come in here to do this with Brain and Spine Surgeons of New York. What is that?
So it's a group of 15 neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons. It's one of the fastest growing private practices in neurosurgery in the state. We operate at a number of hospitals in addition to Vassar Brothers, where I operate, Westchester Medical Center, Northern Westchester, White Plains, and other hospitals. We have a full range of subspecialty expertise. We have surgeons who have been on faculty at Yale, Columbia, or currently.
But what specifically are some of the subspecialties?
So in addition to the kind of the classic complex spine, brain tumors, neurotrauma, we have what we call functional neurosurgery, and that includes deep brain stimulation, but it also includes trigeminal neuralgia and facial pain, or chronic pain where you're placing spinal cord stimulators into patients. And that again becomes, we have one of our partners is particularly skilled and busy in that area. We have pediatric neurosurgeons, we have vascular neurosurgeons. I mean, it really is the full gamut of cutting-edge neurological and surgical care.
Sounds great. Okay, a lot of people on the phone. Two free phones, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Sarah in Poughkeepsie. Okay, Sarah, you're on.
Hi, hello. So my boyfriend for the past 9 months has had chronic headaches. He went to the doctor, the doctor told him, you know, it's not migraines. We don't know exactly what's wrong with you. They did a whole bunch of blood tests. He's gone to the chiropractor. He also is in mixed martial arts, so he had a sternum problem. They broke, essentially his sternum was broken from a fight. And this is way before the headache started, but they haven't really stopped. He has some hip problems. He's been going to the chiropractor. They don't know what's going on with him at all. And I was just wondering, like, what it could possibly be if he needs to go talk to someone else. His next step is an ENT. So mm-hmm. I don't know if that's in the right direction or not, but
so,
yeah.
So another area, Sarah, that he could look into is a neurologist, because neurologists are...
He went to one. The neurologist yeah. doesn't know what's going on with him either.
Did they ever get a CAT scan or an MRI of his brain?
Yep, they did all of that. Everything's clear.
Hmm. That becomes then a tough one. Does he have headaches that are kind of associated with his MMA or at any time?
He hasn't been practicing since the headaches, really. So he only went to one or two practices, and he says, you know, sometimes it's worse when it's at night.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's worse during the day, and the doctor said it could be related to stress. He said, well, you know, I don't think I'm that stressed out, and we've been, you know, moving or whatever, but he yeah. hasn't been that stressed.
Yeah.
So
you know, the fact that the imaging, MRI and CT are clear, that's good news. That means he doesn't need surgery or doesn't have a bigger problem. You know, the other way I would guide you is there are doctors of physical therapy called physiatrists, you know, because just perhaps doing a physical therapy session may not be enough for what he needs, because it sounds like he has sort of a number of complex symptoms. But a physiatrist may be the way to go. If I were to see him in the office and he didn't have anything I could help him with, that's where I would send him.
Sarah, gotta go. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank Appreciate you, bye.
1-800-348-2551. There's just one free phone because Sarah is off. And I got to say that I know a lot of people who are really in pain all the time.
Mm.
And their tests come up zero.
Yeah.
That's got to be tough for you guys.
It's very frustrating, you know, because you want to be able to have a plan. You want to be able to give someone an option. And there are many patients who we can't help.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, let's go to Amy in Deerfield. Amy in Deerfield, you're on.
Hi, I'm wondering if you can comment on all of the recent studies I seem to be reading. They all seem to be new about sleep and the brain. And being a brain expert as you are, what you know and what you believe about the brain and how it behaves, being a surgeon. And if you can comment on the importance of sleep, since we all seem to be shorting ourselves more and more and more.
Sure.
In the sleep department.
Yeah, it seems every few years they come up with whatever the optimal number of hours for sleep would be. And again, it also depends on age and the like. And clearly there's, for every person, there's probably a personalized optimal time for sleep.
Mm.
You know, again, as a neurosurgeon, that's not something we don't look into problems of sleep, like sleep apnea and the like. That tends to be more ENT and neurology.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but
thank you.
But sleep is, of course, incredibly important. So many of us are not good sleepers.
Or deprived of sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll take a short break and we will come right back.
Support comes from the Urological Institute, offering urologic oncology services with prostate specialists using active monitoring protocols designed to help avoid or postpone cancer treatments through imaging and genomic testing. UrologyOncology.com. Mount St. Mary College, Newburgh, offering a liberal arts education and career preparation in the sciences and healthcare. Admissions open house Sunday, November 15th at 9:30. MSMC.edu. Ellis Medicine, offering treatment for people with chronic back, neck, and headache pain at the Ellis Neuroscience Center, ellismedicine.org. Edgar Bosick, Certified Financial Planner, Private Financial Design, South Hadley. Your life, your plan, your portfolio, privatefinancialdesign.com. Securities through Cambridge Investment Research, member FINRA and SIPC. And from Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, specializing in extra-sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported cheddars, specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, local baked goods, honey, and maple products in every corner of our store, waterwheelvillage.com.
And we're back. Great. Okay, we'll go to George in Ballston. Okay. George, is it Ballston Spa? You're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hey, George.
Hey, how are you, doctor? I have a problem with my lower back. It's been about 5-6 years I work in construction, and what happened was, looks like I have like 3-4 discs that are sort of out of shape on the lower back. Now it's affecting my left side of my neck, and lately both of my arms, actually my elbows are a kind of major pain. I got to sleep with my hands straight down, otherwise I can't really fold them to sleep on top of them. And for the past 6-7 months, I have a, looks like the sciatic nerve on the right foot is just kicking like you choke something and it just bounces all over the place all day, all night.
Mm-hmm. What do you do for a living, George?
Construction.
Okay. And so it sounds like you have both either a diagnosed problem in your lumbar spine, because they talked about those discs, and you're also talking about symptoms in your neck, correct?
That's right.
Have you had physical therapy? Have you seen, has anyone evaluated you for it apart from your primary doctor?
Well, I have gone to the other doctors to take a look at it, and seems like one of the things that I really don't like to do, seems like everybody thinks I should do a surgery, but I'm trying to stay away from that.
Sure, but have they, and I agree, the first thing you want to do is not rush to surgery. So there are conservative treatments. Mm-hmm. They're broadly put, they're physical therapy and pain management. Sometimes pain management involves injections into particular areas where perhaps the nerves might be irritated. But, you owe it to yourself to have your doctor get sort of more updated imaging of your neck, because and your lower spine. It sounds like your neck is causing you more trouble more recently, I suspect.
Yeah, because what happened was every time that I have lower back pain, the necks get very irritated.
Yeah, it all kind of goes together. So, you know, I would urge you to have a doctor make referrals to those other specialists so that you can sort of see what your options are. You want to be conservative at first, but ultimately, if these symptoms start to interfere with your daily activities or interfere with your work, and the physical therapy or pain management doesn't help, surgery may be an option for you.
Hey, George, let me just say I had back surgery and it really worked for me. That's all I can say. So thank you, Rick.
Okay.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Shoto.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go to Joan in Albany. Joan, you're on.
Hi. I'll try to be succinct. I've had some more than 20 years worth of issues with my back and various treatments, pain management. I've gone through the whole gamut that you've mentioned, including at one point a discectomy in about 2006 of my lower lumbar 4-5 disc, and then it was redone in 2012. The problem being that when they redid it, they apparently stretched the sciatic nerve to such an extent that it left me with a drop foot on my right side. And now, several years later, I'm looking at a diagnosis of hip arthritis, and I'm set up for surgery in December, very trepidatious about it. And I obviously don't rush to take a surgical option because my big fear is that the sciatic nerve could be harmed on my left side in the left hip operation, and then I'll be in big trouble.
Joan, because we have so many people behind you, just give us the question.
The question has to do with whether, how you recommend I pursue this. Do I go with the hip surgery? Is there any alternative diagnosis that I haven't done? There's been no MRI. There's been an X-ray, which says that my cartilage is gone and I'm bone on bone. I'm a little suspicious if I haven't had an MRI.
I would agree with you. I think an MRI is sort of standard of care for that problem, especially if you're going to think about doing something, as serious as another surgery, particularly a hip replacement or the like. So you do want to get updated imaging of your hip to know. And you also perhaps, and this is very common where people will come to me looking at an orthopedic procedure impending, but because they've also had lumbar or other spine procedures, we look at their spines in an up-to-date way to make sure that one, doesn't mask the other, because sometimes it's hard to distinguish the two. So, but at minimum, getting an MRI of your hip is a good idea.
So how come people don't get MRIs? It seems so clear to me that you should do it.
I think it becomes like practice style, again, depending on who you are. I mean, in my practice, getting an MRI is not necessarily a difficult matter. And especially if my office says, we need an MRI, they tend to listen. So I don't know why. Sometimes, depending on when a doctor is trained, they may be more used to just using plain X-rays or CAT scans, but... for the problem you're describing, I would get an MRI.
How dangerous are they?
An MRI?
Yeah.
It's not really dangerous at all.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Thank you, Joan.
No, I'm not. But you do recommend, and how do you go back to a doctor and say, I think you should do this? You know, as a patient, it's kind of hard to get sometimes in a good position with that. You know what I'm saying? I don't want him to feel I'm challenging him. But
I think if you have have a forthright, honest conversation, just express your concerns, you're not being confrontational. But you do have to ask. If you don't ask the question, you're never going to know.
I would say so. Mm-hmm. Joan, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to, what is that? Anybody see that on top of that? Number five, I think. Is this Cynthia from Woodstock?
Yes. Hi.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hey, Cynthia.
Hi. I 3 years ago, I started having, I had got a knot in the back of my left leg, and I had just had a good quantity of Levaquin, and then in the hospital from pneumonia. And then a couple of months later, I got more, and then the pain started in February, so it's like almost 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, the pain. And... so, I went through physical therapy for a year, and the pain started to travel up.
Cynthia, are you speaking directly into the phone itself? Because we're having a little trouble.
Hang on. Is this good?
It's better, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. So, the pain traveled up into the hamstring. I just had an MRI just a week and a half ago, and it showed I have... stenosis of the spine at L and a herniated L5 disc. But the GP that I spoke with, and I am planning on going to a neurologist in Poughkeepsie, it's horrendous. It's just excruciating, but not all the time. And it starts at the top of my hamstring, and then it'll go down my leg and come across the IT band, and then it'll further travel above this knot that I believe is from the Levaquin. And an orthopedist said it probably was, and he said I probably have the pain for the rest of my life.
Okay, so Cynthia, your question is?
My question is, I thought it was sciatica now, it's in the hamstring and it radiates up and down.
Doctor?
So, Cynthia, I think it's a good idea to have a neurologist evaluate you. You know, a general practitioner doesn't look at these MRIs on a daily basis. And even if they're reading them, they're often reading the report. So it's hard to correlate what an MRI shows with what your symptoms are. So a neurologist or neurosurgeon, but if you have a neurologist appointment, that's going to start to... clear the matter, I think.
I had an neurologist appointment with Dr. Should I say the name? Dr. Ranaday.
No, we don't want to hear. We don't want names. So go ahead.
But I think that's a good idea.
Okay, but he suggested that I go to a neurosurgeon.
Okay, and that's a very good point of departure. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. So my question to you, doctor, is when do you go to a neurologist as opposed to a neurosurgeon?
It is a good question. So generally neurologists are dealing with non-surgical diseases, but that doesn't mean that a neurologist won't see a patient with a herniated disc in their neck or in their back. A neurologist could see a patient with a brain tumor because they're coming in with headaches.
Sure. So why not skip the introductory course and go directly, or courses, and go directly to the neurosurgeon?
And that often is what happens. I mean, it really all depends on where you're practicing. So, for example, for me, I will see patients that may not even have updated MRIs. They may have a CAT scan from some time ago because we want to be able to take care of them. So that means come into the office, we'll get the right films, we'll get the right studies, and then we'll be able to guide the care. So we really don't kind of say no to anyone in terms of coming in. So I don't really have a bias as to whether patients come in through my office or through a neurologist, but it's an open door policy.
I've been struck, by the way, very quickly about your decency in saying go see a neurologist, because in the old days we all know that there used to be some antipathy between the neurologists and the neurosurgeons. But I think that's been closing, hasn't it?
I think so. I think we have our own turf. You know, there are always particular areas of overlap. Orthopedic spine surgeons and neurosurgeons will always have healthy debates. Neurologists and neurosurgeons as well.
Yep. Okay, so we'll go to Susan in Duanesburg. Susan, you're on. Go.
Hi, doctor. I have a question. My stepdaughter is developmentally delayed. She's a severe epileptic. And when she was in her late 30s, she had the operation where they split the brain in half to calm down the seizure activity.
Yes.
And I guess my one question is, how effective is that operation? And my second question is, prior to the surgery, she was able to speak. She had developmental issues, but she was able to speak.
Yeah.
But since the operation, she really lost her ability to speak. And I didn't know if there were any studies that show that was one of the complications. I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Yeah, epilepsy surgery is a very specialized area where, and generally that's done in academic centers because you need so many different physicians to be part of that, and it becomes kind of the last resort. And there are a number of kind of surgical approaches. So the procedure you discussed is one approach. We also do things where we do vagal nerve stimulation for epilepsy, and these are patients who have failed medical therapy, who nothing else works.
She has a vagal nerve stimulator.
She has that as well. Did she have that after her original surgery?
No, before.
Peter, what is a vagal nerve?
So the vagal nerve is a nerve that runs along the carotid artery complex. It's a parasympathetic modulator. And so what we found, and again, just like so many of these stimulatory procedures, they were found sometimes almost by accident, that they found that by stimulating the nerve with a particular pulse sequence, they were able to decrease the frequency of seizures in a certain population.
And one more question. What exactly is a seizure?
So a seizure is an uncontrolled electrical activity in the brain that will tend to start in one location and then propagate. So they talk about a seizure focus, often in the temporal lobes, but then that seizure or that electrical activity, that uncontrolled activity, will then travel to other parts of the brain. So that's why I'm saying this is a very complicated matter. And when you're thinking about surgery, you really want to be at a place that does a lot of those kind of surgeries and has the full complement of specialists. I assume that your daughter likely went through levels of monitoring, right? She probably had EEG monitoring, 24-hour monitoring. She may have even had electrodes implanted in the brain or not, depending on, again, where she was and what happened. But, they don't take that kind of procedure lightly.
Right. Yeah, it became very complicated. She had some brain swelling, and they had to put her in. She was like in a coma, stupefy, they called it.
Yeah.
But anyways, I didn't know, because she has really lost her ability to speak, and I didn't know if that was a complication. It sounded like maybe the surgery's gone was not a successful surgery, but nobody's actually saying that,
Yeah, no, I understand. And again, the best way to approach that is to be able to have an honest, forthright conversation with your surgeon. You have got to be able to pose the question. You don't want to assume, well, this may or may not have been, an expected issue. But you have a right to let your concerns be known.
But you can do it nicely as opposed to up against the wall.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, Susan, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348 2551. We've heard by email. Hello, doctors. I'm a 54-year-old male and had a C6-7 fusion a number of years ago and herniated disc at C4-5 and 5-6 that were asymptomatic. The neurosurgeon recommended against fusing these. I recently found out that I have several herniated discs in the lumbar region. Are there subtle symptoms of lumbar herniated discs I should watch out for so I may be able to avoid the more profoundly painful symptoms I experience with the C6-7 disc should these become symptomatic?
That's a good question. So, again, we're going by email. So the first question I would have is why they got a lumbar MRI. I'm assuming this individual had back pain and or leg pain.
I can't tell because it's an email.
Yeah, that's right. So we're going to kind of work the story backwards. But if his question is, how long do I wait before I seek treatment of one kind or another? I would say, again, the first order of treatment is conservative for these issues. So if this patient has back pain and some leg pain that sort of comes and goes one side or another, I would certainly want to try physical therapy and or pain management first. I would want them to have an evaluation by a neurosurgeon or an orthopedic spine surgeon, though I guess my bias is neurosurgeon. I work with orthopedic spine surgeons, so it's a good team approach makes sense. But just staying on top of your symptoms.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. We'll go to James in Highland, New York. Okay, James, your turn.
Alan, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
We're good.
Great fun drive. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question for the doctor. Actually, it's a two-part question. Did the doctor ever hear of intracranial hypertension? That's my first question.
Intracranial? Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Could you expand on that a little bit? Because my wife was diagnosed with that about a year and a half ago.
Uh-huh.
And she was put on this medicine, Diamox.
Right.
And the Diamox actually aggravated her symptoms.
And what were her symptoms?
Her symptoms was just a severe pressure headache. Coughing, sneezing, bending over made it worse. There were days where she couldn't get out of bed, and then there was other days where she was feeling so-so. Mm-hmm. But to sum it all up, for about a year and a half, she was living with the headache, and she still has the headache. We were dealing with a neurologist, and that's a direction that one neurologist went. Then we went to another one for a second opinion, and that individual was going in a different direction. We finally went to a neurosurgeon, and he is saying that she has a slight Chiari malformation, if I'm saying that correct.
No, you are.
And we're going for another test, I guess, that's going to measure the it's an MRI, and I guess it measures the flow
of CSF. It's an MRI where they can measure the flow of spinal fluid around that area in the brain, the back of the brain. Has she ever had a lumbar tap, a spinal tap?
Yes, she did. Her opening pressure, I believe, was about 30.
That's high.
But it was high, but when they did it, they didn't do it in the sitting position. They did it in the laying position.
Okay, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, there are different ways you can get the pressure, but in a sitting or standing or laying position, 30, and I'm assuming there's a certain measurement for that 30, is a higher number. That's higher than normal. Did anyone ever talk about a shunt for her?
Yes, actually, she had a friend that she went to school with that's experiencing the same problem, and she had the shunt put in, and she has worse problems with it now.
Yeah.
There was no benefit with the shunt.
What does the shunt do, doctor?
Where was the shunt, sir? Was it in her back or in the brain?
It was in the brain, mm-hmm. and they vented it out into the stomach.
Gotcha. So what he's describing is what's called a ventriculoperitoneal shunt. Ventricle is the fluid space in the brain. Peritoneum is the cavity where the internal organs are. And the reasoning behind it is that there is the feeling that with this condition, there is a overproduction of spinal fluid. That's why they tried a medication that he mentioned called Diamox, which is supposed to slow down the production. Yeah. Sounds like that didn't help. Then by doing the spinal tap and seeing that the pressure was high, the next step from a surgical point of view, if there is surgery, is looking at ways in which you can divert the spinal fluid from the brain to the peritoneum, or sometimes you'll also
do it. That's the shunt.
The shunt, yeah. Or you can also put a catheter in the lumbar spine and put it into the same space. You know, they probably looked at both things. The ventriculoperitoneal shunt tends to be more effective, tends to work longer. But again, from what you described, sir, it sounds like that didn't help either.
Why is having a high pressure, like 30, when you do the tap, why is that important?
Well, it's important to be able to measure the pressure because that then guides, you know, if someone has high pressure, higher pressures than what is physiologically normal, there's some issue. You know, again, there are lots of reasons to have high pressure, so it's important. It's an important diagnostic tool.
It's like holding your thumb over a garden hose. It increases the pressure, and that puts the pressure on the brain.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like they went through, you know, all these steps, and now you're saying they're looking at the
Chiari malformation. Yes.
Well, you know, so let's be honest. She's had two interventions, right? A medical intervention and a shunt.
No. She didn't have the shunt. Her friend had the shunt. We didn't opt for the shunt. We went for a second opinion.
Yeah, no, that, yeah.
And now they ruled out the IH, and they're saying that she has Chiari malformation.
Chiari, yeah. Okay, I get it.
Okay, listen, James, I wish we could go on longer, but we can't because we have to take a little break, and we'll be right back. And thank you,
James.
Do you
have a website, Doc?
Yes.
Go ahead.
It's Brain and Spine Surgeons of New York, but the acronym is B. Like brain, BSSNY.com.
BSSNY.com.
Right.
Got it.
We're all on there with our fine smiling portraits.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, but a lot of information on the site, so hopefully that'll be of help as well, sir.
And for all of you who don't know it, you can watch the doctor live, real time, by going to WMC.org and just clicking on the right button. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Alan.
Yeah, thanks. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Bassett Healthcare Network, providing healthcare services across central New York. We see people, not patients. Bassett.org. Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, with a second shop now open on Windmere Avenue in the heart of Greenwood Lake. YeOldWarwickBookshop.com. Temple Sinai, Saratoga Springs, New York, an open congregation welcoming the Jewish community and visitors for Shabbat, holiday services, their religious school, cultural programs, and more. SaratogaSinai.org. Nine Pin Cider, serving New York hard ciders made from locally sourced apples. Tasting Room, open Wednesday through Saturday at 929 Broadway, downtown Albany. Be revolutionary, consider the apple, ninepincider.com. And from College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com.
And we are back, and we're delighted to be back here with Dr. Peter Zejos, who is talking to us today about all the things about the brain and the spinal cord and things that have made a lot of people call up. There's actually one free phone right now. Let's go to Andy in Bloomingburg. Okay, Andy, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, very much.
Andy. Yeah. My daughter was, oddly enough, diagnosed with a Chiari malformation, which I had never heard of. Now I just hear the previous caller has the same issue. She had surgery, and the malformation had caused her spinal fluid to back up into a syrinx in her spine.
Right.
That was about 6 or 7 inches long. And what are the chances that will shrink and drain back up or whatever?
Yeah. So she had what's called a decompression. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. So that is the first line of treatment, of surgical treatment for a Chiari.
What is a Chiari again?
So a Chiari is a congenital malformation of the brain where the back of the brain, we call it the posterior fossa, and the cerebellum are all crowded in, and they begin to crowd the large opening at the base of the skull called the foramen magnum. The foramen magnum is where the spinal cord goes through. In a generally normal anatomic state, the cerebellum isn't supposed to be perched or going through that opening. But in a Chiari, there are different levels at which the cerebellum, or what's called the tonsils of the cerebellum, so one portion of it, will protrude through that area, and that then implies that there is a crowding and perhaps a blockage of spinal fluid. So the idea is that by taking some of the bone, it's actually, you know, it's not a insignificant procedure. You actually take away some of the bone in the very back of the brain, heading to the foramen magnum. You often will open up the lining of the brain called the dura and patch it, so you give the contents more room. And then, so to answer your question, in most cases, a syrinx either will not progress after that surgery or can often resolve. So generally, that is the first way that we treat it. There are some cases where you attack the syrinx first. If someone perhaps doesn't have a Chiari associated with a syrinx, there are ways of shunting that syrinx. We mentioned shunt earlier, again, where you're putting a tube in a space and diverting it to another area. So the odds are good, to answer your question, that the syrinx will either resolve or stay stable. Does she have symptoms from the syrinx?
She did prior to the surgery, and they have alleviated somewhat.
That's good news.
Since then, yeah.
You know, it's a complex...
Scary thing.
Yeah, it's scary, and it's a complex matter because we're sort of treating... We're not really getting we don't understand why that development happens, why congenitally people have that, but we're treating a side effect of that development by taking away the bone and all that, and hoping that does the job. So the fact that she has some improvement of symptoms is encouraging at this stage, for sure.
Well, it took 6 months to diagnose it. They had her everything from Lyme disease to you name it, but she was developing tremors and short-term memory loss and urinary frequency and any number of things that were odd for a perfectly healthy young lady.
Understood.
Well, Andy, we're with you. Keep thinking about us, and we'll keep thinking about you. Thank you, Andy. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Yeah, bye.
Let's go to Ann in Suffield. Ann, you're on.
Hi. I'm a 59-year-old woman. I was diagnosed 5 years ago with a meningioma, paraphalcine. It's about 1.7 to 1.9 centimeters, depending on where the MRIs are done. I have no symptoms. It was a subsidy. I fell and knocked myself out, and that's how they found it. I had headaches 20 years ago. They looked, didn't see anything, so it grew in that period of time. At this point, I'm asymptomatic. I would love to spend the rest of my life without having this thing cut out of my head.
Yep.
I'm happy where I am. So the question at this point is, how often should I be going for an MRI? I mean,
so
everyone,
sure. So when were you first diagnosed? What year? How many years?
It's been 5 years.
And you've had three MRIs since then?
Yes.
Okay. You know, so generally...
So the initial one and then two more.
And were each of those a year apart or 2 years apart? How long were they?
It was the initial one, then 1 year apart, then 2 years apart.
Gotcha.
And this following winter is when I'm meant to either go for my next every other year, or say, I'm willing to go 5 years, 10 years, when I have symptoms, years, at that point.
I understand. You know, and so there's no...
Before you answer, doctor, could you tell everybody what a meningioma is?
Sure. So a meningioma is generally a benign growth of the lining of the brain called the meninges. And there are cells that will predisposed to meningioma that are in certain locations. One of them is where your location is in that paraphalcine region. Paraphalcine means just to the one side or the other of the midline. The falx, the false, is in the very center of the brain. So the fact is, generally, these grow very slowly, if at all. The fact now that you have three MRIs that sort of show either no growth or very minimal, sounds like, you know, as you said, it depends on where you're getting the MRI and who's reading it, you know, so a couple of millimeters here or there. My practice is generally to continue to increase the timing between MRIs. So if you had, you know, the last one was 2 years, I'd go 3 years. And then if that's good, then I'd go 4 years. You know, yes, you don't want to be getting them every year. And the only thing that changes that is if you do notice a change in your headache pattern, a change in symptoms, perhaps some changes, again, depending on where this is, you might have some changes in sensation in your arm or in your leg or some weakness
in
one area.
You said leg.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense. But, you know, you're not committed to every other, you know, every year MRIs, that's for sure.
So, well, last question on this issue, and then we'll go back to the phones. And that is, do we know how these meningiomas are, why they're formed?
We do not.
Okay.
No. We don't know how most brain tumors form. We know that there are genetic switches that are turned on. We know that women have a greater incidence of meningioma than men because there is a hormonal association with estrogen. Mm. But the fact is, if you come to my office and you have a tumor of one kind or another, I still don't know why you have it and someone else doesn't.
Great. Thank you for that. 1-800-348-2551. And we'll go to John in Albany. Okay, John, you're on.
Hey, hi.
Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question. I just was wondering if the doctor could speak about the disc replacement that was mentioned earlier in the program. I think you said it was like a non-invasive disc replacement that they were working on.
So disc replacement is first of all, it's not non-invasive. You know, this is a surgery, and you know, if I may ask, are you talking about the neck or the lumbar spine?
For particular, I have a herniated disc L4 through S1.
Yeah.
So lumbar spine. Yeah. In my case, yeah.
You know, it's kind of challenging to know when, particularly in the lumbar spine, when that becomes appropriate. There's more data, and certainly more of a, if not a consensus, at least some kind of plan as far as using artificial discs for cervical spine disease. Often patients who are younger, patients who may have, may not require a full fusion. In the lumbar spine, it's a little more problematic. There are a number of studies where they did disc replacement and found that those patients ultimately fused anyway, which kind of argues against that procedure. The idea of a disc replacement is that you're maintaining some degree of the normal anatomy, as opposed to a fusion where you're taking the disc entirely out, putting in bone or some bone substitutes, putting in screws or some other instrumentation, and then fixing that segment of spine in place. So, you know, here's the challenge with these kind of procedures. You can go to five different spine surgeons, and you'll get five different recommendations.
Ooh.
So I wish I could guide you on this, depends on who you go to.
Hey, John, we could spend more time, but we're running out of time here. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, let's go to Joanne in Rhinebeck. Okay, Joanne, if you can, keep it brief. Go ahead.
Hi. I have been diagnosed with Lyme for a couple of decades. I finally went and had a spinal tap, and the neurologist found 2 to 3 live bands in the brain. And I was wondering if you have any ideas about Lyme and the brain.
Well, so I'll admit that problem is entirely not a neurosurgical problem. You know, there's no surgery for that issue. It's medication, you know, and diagnosis. So no, I don't have any particular insight into there.
And the medication is what, antibiotics?
Yes.
Yeah. Joanne, I'm so sorry. Okay. That's what we got.
Nope.
Thanks a lot.
That's great.
Thanks
Thank
a lot.
You. Thank Bye. You. Bye-bye.
Yeah. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Lisa in Albany. Okay, Lisa, you're on.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with cherry malformation. Is this something that is caused in utero while the fetus is forming, and is it caused by a lack of certain nutrients?
It seems like this cherry malformation is a popular topic today. What we know is that it is a congenital, that is, you know, a condition that occurs very early in life. Whether it occurs in utero or soon after depends on the type of cherry malformation. There are a number of types of it. As far as whether it's associated with particular, you know, nutritional deficiencies, I mean, there is some data out there to that effect, but there's nothing strong. There's no strong correlation, and part of it is because this isn't a very common, despite the interest today, it's not a very common condition. So there hasn't been an association between vitamin supplements or the lack thereof and the development of this condition.
Lisa, gotta let you go. Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Gene in Poughkeepsie. Gene, you're on. If you can keep it short, we'd appreciate it. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm calling with respect to, I had a labyrinthectomy in my right ear two years ago, and I was told at the time that my brain would react to it, and that I would, and eventually it would come back, and I would be back to normal, but it hasn't. So my question is, the best direction for me to take now would be a neurologist or a neurosurgeon or a neuro-otologist?
It's the last one. Did a neuro-otologist do that procedure, or was it a general ENT doctor?
It was an otolaryngologist in New York.
Yeah.
And what is that, Doc?
So that is she may have had an inflammation of the labyrinth, so the inner ear. Again, not my area of specialization.
Yes. But it was intractable Meniere's disease.
Yes. So, and often people will see the neurologist first because they do the diagnosis, mm-hmm. or it comes through the regular ENT doctor. There are a lot of ways in which the diagnosis is nailed down. But I would absolutely recommend if you're having either persistent or recurrent symptoms to have a neuro-otologist, because that is among their many areas of specialization. That is one of their areas.
Gene, gotta let you go. Thank you very much.
Okay,
very quickly, Gary in Amsterdam, you can ask it in 3 seconds. You can have your question. Go ahead.
Hello.
Gary, you got to make it fast.
Hi, Gary.
Benign tremors. I've been diagnosed with that. On top of that, I'm a 51-year type 1 diabetic. Mm-hmm. Would there be any connection?
Yes, there can be. And how long have you had the tremors?
I've had them for a few years. I was diagnosed with benign without any type of test being done. So, mm-hmm.
So have you seen a neurologist? Because that's really the way to go here. Because you want to be able to determine that the tremors are not induced by medication or not essential tremor, which is distinct from benign tremor. So, see a neurologist would be my recommendation.
Next time you come back, you're going to give us a tour through all of the tremors.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Gary. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Okay. Thanks.
We are out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in and apologize to no one because no one was left on. Well, maybe somebody was left online. I'd also like to thank Dr. Peter Zejos for joining me today and all of us. Support for Medical Monday comes from Nathan Littauer Hospital, proudly introducing the gastroenterology specialist of Littauer with Dr. Alvarez, Dr. Ramani, Dr. Raymond, NLH.org. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall, and I'm Alan Chartok. On tomorrow's program, it's the Copyright Forum. If you think somebody stole your poem, you're going to want to call in. Stay tuned now for a news update.